Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of IGN Unfiltered, my monthly interview series where I get to sit down with the best, brightest, most interesting minds in the games industry. My guest this month is Phil Harrison. He is currently the vice president and general manager at Google on Google Stadia. So we're going to talk all about their streaming gaming service that's launching right now. But Phil was also an executive for a long time at PlayStation and then at Microsoft for a bit, too. So lots to talk to him about. Enjoy.
Have you always been a gamer, or did you find that your path into the games industry was an unexpected one? I'm always curious.
It was an unexpected career, for sure. But yes, I've always been a game player and a game maker. I started with an accidental Christmas gift one holiday with a Commodore 64.
Nice.
Which had that incredible moment where you switched it on and it just said ready, and there was a blinking cursor. And that was just an invitation to go do something amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think like a number of people of my generation, I started by typing listings in from magazines and making games that way. You then realize that the thing you've spent 14 hours typing in isn't very good. So you then change it. So you learn a little bit of game design and a little bit of the principles of, you know, debugging code and things like that. And what really got me excited was graphics, how I could have something in my head that I could then, you know, with a few pixels, then turn into a story or a character.
What games stood out for you as a child, either on the Commodore or other platforms?
I think there's a number of sort of seminal moments that I remember. I think going around to a friend's house and seeing an Atari 2600 for the first time. Even before that, what was the predecessor to the Intellivision and Pong, and just the paddle game experience, and just being able to control something on the television. That was like a magical moment. I think I was probably 6 or 7 years old at that point.
Yeah.
But playing games on the Commodore 64 from some of the great game companies. I think I loved a lot of the LucasArts games early on. I love some of the early Activision games, Little Computer People Discovery Kit. I don't know if you remember that.
That one is not familiar to me.
Oh, you should check it out. It's a very, very simple idea, which was this notion of an AI that lived inside your computer. And he was a little count. It was like a kind of visually rich Tamagotchi, where you had a character that you had to look after, you had to feed it, you had to kind of play with it and interact with it. And if he got bored, or she, actually I can't remember the gender, but if they got bored, they would lean forward as if they were on the inside of your computer monitor and knock on the inside of the glass.
Good.
And there was this really amazing sound effect, which you probably won't be able to pick up, but it just, it was just perfect. And I was like, that was great game design. So those kind of moments, and then from there, I managed to turn it into a little bit of a job on the side when I was early teens, doing graphics for friends who were making games. My first public published work was on a computer called the Oric One, which absolutely nobody will ever have heard of.
I cannot say I have, I'm afraid.
Imagine an 8-bit computer with all the smart bits of a Commodore 64 taken away.
Oh.
So that was basically how it worked. I got paid £50, I think, for the graphics that I did, age 14. And I thought,
wow,
this is the future.
Yeah, that had to... Did that just like crystallize it and make it real for you at that point?
I think I was too young to think of it in terms of a career arc and, I had no idea what kind of an industry, I was getting myself into. But the idea of being a freelancer and being able to work on other people's games as a graphic artist and then as a game designer and then eventually as a producer was just thrilling. I loved it. And so I decided to take a risk and I left school when I was 16.
Wow. Were your parents thrilled about that?
Oh, they were absolutely delighted, as you can imagine. And I'm not that far away from potentially the same conversation with my own kids. Mm. And so I can imagine that.
You don't have a leg to stand on in that conversation.
I've never told them this story. So
turn it off.
When they come to watch this, I am completely screwed. But it was just a moment in my life where I realized I had an opportunity and I wanted to do it. And I kind of did a deal with them, which was, if it doesn't work out in a year, I'll go back and finish school. And then I wound the clock forward a few years, and I was living here in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and I was an executive at PlayStation, and I flew them out for a vacation.
Yeah.
And I sat them down over dinner, and I said, do you remember that deal that I did you a few years ago? Are we kind of... square?
Are we good?
Are we good on this? And it was a fun moment.
I'm always wondering about the parental reactions to successful game designers and game industry figures, because it's especially to, we're still the kids now would, like your kids, if they were to go into it, I'm sure you'd be perfectly supportive and accepting of, yes, of course, this is a normal and prosperous thing you can do. But our generation, I would imagine a lot of parents would have just thought, well, this is insane. What's my Correct. Child doing with their life?
Correct. And I'm not sure I really gave them much choice, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it's I think also back then it wasn't an industry. It wasn't a business that you could really point to and say, it has these kind of economic benefits and these kind of advantages or this kind of route to market. It wasn't a clear way for anybody to be successful in it. And so, but now that's obviously, completely changed.
You actually got started. You fast forwarded to Sony there, which we'll get to in a second.
Yeah, sorry, I jumped ahead a little bit.
Mindscape.
Yeah.
Did a bunch of PC games, even some Nintendo games, mm-hmm. NES games. So that's like the first professional. So were you maybe not even 18 then if you'd kind of gone out at 16?
So there's a little bit in the middle where I worked freelance for a bunch of UK-based game development companies and built up a little portfolio of work, which had some merit to it, I think, and then was approached. Now, I wrote a letter to the guy who ran Mindscape in the UK and said, hey, I'm a game designer, would you like to... see my portfolio, and he invited me down. They were in a beautiful location in the countryside south of London, and I sat with him for half an hour and I walked him through my portfolio, and his eyes kind of glazed over, and he said, look, the honest answer is I don't understand a word of this. Would you like to come and work for me?
Wow.
And figure this out for me. And we hit it off. His name's Jeff Heath. He's still a friend today. He's a wonderful mentor to me. So somebody who gave me a real break when I was 19.
That's astoundingly honest for someone in a sort of hiring position like that.
And he was building an organization in Europe. He was the European division of Mindscape, which is a very established, at the time, US games publisher with a lot of excitement around their Nintendo business. And I spent a really fun 3 years there.
Well, I want to know next then. So how did you end up joining Sony then? How do you go from Mindscape and Sony in the, at this point would be the pre-PlayStation days?
Yes. In fact, the time, was a really interesting one in the history of PlayStation and Sony, because the relationship, I mean, this is well covered in the lore of the games industry, but the relationship between Sony and Nintendo to build the original PlayStation had just broken down. And so they were right at the beginning of thinking about how to build their own business as their own operator in the games industry, as their own platform. And so I got a call from a friend who had moved over to Sony in the US. And I got a call from a guy called Olaf Olofsson, who was running the electronic publishing business for Sony out of the US. And I met him at some ungodly hour of the morning at Heathrow Airport. It was the only time we could meet.
At the airport?
Yeah, it was a bizarre interview.
Were you flying anywhere?
No, he was flying somewhere.
Oh, okay. That makes
and so
sense.
I get a call from his assistant like the day before saying, Mr. Olofsson will be at Heathrow Airport at like 6:20 tomorrow morning.
Wow.
Please meet him there. And I'm like, okay. Small sidebar story. I managed to get stung by a bee while cutting my lawn the night before, which was kind of weird. And then by...
Where? Like, so was it like swollen on your face?
No, it was on my thumb. Okay. It was on my thumb. By 7 o'clock, I had a job.
Huh.
It was a very, very bizarre set of circumstances.
All right, so the CD-ROM add-on that Sony was going to make for Nintendo, were you involved in that at all?
No, I was not. And that was the project that had just finished before I joined the company. And it finished in rather acrimonious circumstances.
I remember reading about it, yeah.
And the vision was... the plan was that Sony would make a combined unit, which was a Super Nintendo and a CD drive mixed together.
Yeah.
Sony already made the sound chip for the Super Nintendo, so that was the thing that created the relationship. In fact, Mr. Kutaragi, who founded PlayStation, was the engineer responsible
That's right.
for the sound chip. So that was the kind of thread in history. And then... Nintendo would make a standalone drive with supply components by Sony. And then at the very last minute, for very complex business reasons, the project was abandoned. And it was quite embarrassing for Sony at the time. And the team was given the permission to go and build a competing platform. And so I joined right at the perfect timing. I mean, it was not luck. I mean, it wasn't planned. It was complete luck.
Do you ever stop and think, was that dissolving of that partnership the best thing that ever happened to your career, in a way?
Yes, almost certainly. But actually, more importantly than my career, nobody should really care about my career.
Well, I care. That's why you're here.
Well, bless you. But I think actually it was the best thing that ever happened for the industry, because it stimulated a huge amount of creativity and innovation at the developer level and at the publisher level and at the economic level.
Sure.
And it transitioned an industry that was doing great but wasn't going to become a mass market business. And the decisions to add a disk drive put so much value back into the development community.
Right, because the cost off of the cartridge.
Exactly, yeah. You know, some of the projects that I was involved with at Mindscape, the physical cartridge cost $15 a unit.
Wow.
And if you make a mistake ordering too many, you are dead. And if you order too few, it took too long to replenish supply.
An equally bad problem in a totally different way.
You could never get it right.
Yeah.
You were always doomed.
Yeah.
One way
and
or
then
the other.
Still, you know, Nintendo's got to get their, or, you know, the platform holders got to get their cut.
Yeah,
that
so
too,
it was
so.
It was very, very expensive. Oof. And unpleasant business to be in.
So you're at Sony. You had quite the rise up the company ladder, which we'll get more into. You've been involved in every Sony hardware launch up through the PS3.
Yep.
So I'm just curious now, you know, you've got 10 plus years to look back on it. What was there any that was your favorite, that any launch that you remember like, man, that one was particularly fun or interesting in some way?
I think obviously because it was pioneering and breaking new ground, PlayStation 1 was the thing that I look back on with most fondness, partly because of the product that we were building, but also partly because of the team that we were constructing. when I joined the PlayStation group, which was called Computer Entertainment Project Number One, I never found out if there was a Computer Entertainment Project Number Two, but when I joined that group, I think we were 45 or 50 people worldwide, most of whom were in Japan. I was the first person outside of Japan.
Oh, interesting.
And then, obviously, when I left, I think we had more than 5,500 people.
Wow.
So, yes, it was a pretty amazing growth. But I think that moment of seeing the promise of a platform delivered with amazing game experiences that you could see. And I've told this story before, but the moment when I went to Namco prior to the launch of PS1 and saw Ridge Racer up and running, you know, that was like a, oh, okay, actually, I think we're onto something here. And at that very same meeting, they said, because that bit of the demo had gone so well, they said, we're working on something else. Would you like to come and have a look? And we're like, sure, sounds great. And it was Tekken. So, you know, seeing those two games within an hour of each other for the first time was pretty exciting. And then I think, you know, when we got into the super heady heights of PlayStation 2, we realized the impact that we were having culturally and socially. The games that were really starting to hit their heights was so exciting.
Yeah, could you have, I mean, the PS1 was a success. You're doing the PS2, you know, the Toy Story graphics, Pixar graphics. But
I don't think we ever said that. Okay. I think it was somebody else who
said
that.
Fair enough. But I mean, did you guys at all foresee the record heights that the PS2 was going to go, would ultimately hit? Like, I'm sort of curious how taken by surprise, if at all, the Sony team was by how well the PS2 did.
I think we had a period in the early 2000s where PS2 was, demand was outstripping supply, and we were never in stock.
Wow.
And it was particularly in the US and Europe. Japan, because they were closer to the factories, it was easier for them to have a slightly more just-in-time delivery. But in the US and Europe, we were constantly out of stock. And there was one moment where we had a company meeting, and I forget the exact date, but we were 1% of Sony's people, 10% of Sony's revenue,
wow,
and 90% of Sony's profits.
Well, look who's the golden goose now. That's
right.
Crazy.
Yeah, and so that, you know, that's actually now been repeated, I think, more recently as well. So
with the PS4, yeah. I imagine, yeah. So was there a specific moment, do you think, that with the PS2, or was it more of a, because for me, I will tell you that I had a killer app moment with the PS2, because I'd been a PC gamer from, you know, Nintendo as a kid, and then I went through the 16-bit era. I had a couple of the 16-bit consoles, but Doom turned me into a PC gamer.
Sure.
Which I was for many years. And then what actually brought me back to console gaming was Grand Theft Auto 3.
Sure.
That was, did you have any sort of sense of that at the time? I mean, they were over on your side of the pond at the time as well. Like, did you guys have any idea that what that game was going to do?
I think the honest answer is no. And I think that GTA 1 and 2, obviously a different format, you know, kind of
top-down
view, but had very high reviews, very high quality, was showing some really innovative, strong innovation in terms of game design. But I don't think anybody could really have predicted the absolute impact that GTA 3 and then beyond would have. Sam may have a different view.
I'm trying to get him in here. It's tough to pin those guys down.
I'll ask him.
Please, I'd appreciate it. Yeah, any little bit of help is welcome.
And I think, yes, obviously Grand Theft Auto had a huge impact, because the way that we marketed the platform was to make it an aspirational device, not to make it a toy, but to make it something that anybody of our age or, you know, younger could enjoy.
Yeah.
And I think that plus the rise of FIFA on the, particularly in Europe, Madden here in the US, sports games becoming such a powerful part of the industry. Games like Metal Gear Solid, you know, I think starting to really drive a huge amount of excitement in the industry. And so there was a number of, I think, franchises that just became part of people's lives.
Yeah, it's and they still are all these years
Correct.
Later.
Yeah,
that's,
exactly.
That's what's wild about it. So we fast forward to the PlayStation 3. As the PS2 was the DVD Trojan horse in the living room, so too was the PlayStation 3 attempting to do the same for Blu-ray.
Yeah.
When that sort of format war, nobody remembers now. Like, it's such ancient history. How was the format war between HD DVD and Blu-ray looked at within Sony? Like, was it just these guys, the other format has no chance? We've got, like, I'm sort of curious about that from your side as being involved with the PlayStation business.
It was a very important format to get right. And I think for various reasons, perhaps Sony feels a little bit more acutely aware of losing a format war.
From Betamax VHS,
and VHS.
Yeah.
So I think there was a little bit more focus on these things in the electronic side of the business. And I remember a number of meetings where there were, you know, pretty serious checks being written to incentivize certain movie studios to bring their catalog to Blu-ray
right.
first versus HD DVD. And it was pretty finely balanced for a few months. And then I might have misremembered it, but I think it was Warner Brothers who said, no, actually, we're all in on Blu-ray. And that kind of tipped the scale.
Scales, yeah. I remember it being pretty obvious that Blu-ray was going to win because of exactly what you're saying. Like, the list was like, oh, well, there's just more and bigger support for Blu-ray. But with regard to the PS3, now, that was sort of has been looked at by some, you may not feel this way, but as sort of Sony's little hubris going on. Did you guys have any idea that people were going to latch on to the you know, the $599 thing and the, you know, the giant enemy crab for Massive? Like, did that whole unveil, like, did it catch you off guard after the PlayStation 3 reveal?
Yeah, so I think there was two moments. I think the 2005 E3 where we showed the platform promise got everybody very, very excited.
Yeah.
And then once the reality hit home of just how expensive it was going to be, and I think some of the reaction from the audience was justifiably concerned. And it also coincided with the rise of the internet as a platform for users to really express their opinions. And I think in some ways it caught many companies, not just us, you know, off guard. You know,
sure.
The balance of power had shifted a little bit, and we had to invest way more in understanding our users and their passions.
Was there any internal concern or debate about that $599 price point? I mean, yes, there was a there was a $499 model, I think, too. But was it the 20 gig hard drive? Or I don't remember which one
it was. Yeah, no, it was. You're right. It was the 20.
But you could barely, like, it was not the one that was really marketed or pushed, as I recall it. But was that $600, was that a worry internally at all?
It was a worry because $600 was actually too cheap because the machine was so expensive to make.
Yeah.
And this is normal in a console business, that the first few hundred thousand machines you make cost a ton,
right?
And then you quickly come down the cost curve,
yeah.
and you get into you know, profit later. But the first machines of PS3 were way more expensive than the $599 retail price that we charged.
That's interesting. I mean, I know, you know, that's not a new thing, as you said, but to, just the way you're phrasing it is. Now I'm curious what the actual figure was.
I'm not sure it's public information, and I probably shouldn't share it.
Fair enough.
But it would make your eyebrows shoot clear off the top of your head.
All right, then. Your favorite PlayStation games over the years. I mean, you were so closely tied for so long. I'm sort of curious what some of your near and dear franchises were.
So I think, because I had a couple of different roles in my time at PlayStation, for probably the first half of my time, I was very much involved in all games, all platform. And
yeah.
So I was, you know, really focused on bringing as many developers and publishers onto the platform as possible. And then from 2000 onwards was running studios and then eventually worldwide studios. And so there I was much more focused on our internal teams. And I think personally, just because I'm a car enthusiast, Gran Turismo will always have a place in my life. Some of the more esoteric things that our team in Japan signed will always be, I think, that recognition of art over commerce. And I loved the fact that we did those. Things like Parappa the Rapper and Umjamalami and those games, which I think weren't necessarily the biggest commercial success, but the very fact that they were on the platform was exciting. And then I think because they were more finely curated by my team, a game like Little Big Planet probably is something that I always remember very closely.
Awesome. Was the PS3, was it a year late? That was always sort of the story. Was it supposed to launch alongside around the same time as the 360 in fall of 05? I don't know if that's a real story or just an urban legend.
I think we always said winter. And the good news is that winter in the Northern Hemisphere is a sort of fairly broad spread. I honestly can't remember. Yes, it was later than I think we would have wished for.
Yeah.
And the thing that actually slowed down the production on the hardware was down to a tiny component. It was the laser diode on the Blu-ray drive.
Really?
Yeah, it was like a 5-cent component.
Interesting.
Yeah,
And was it a volume thing? Like, yeah. So, because, like, I know, you know, Elon Musk talks about this with Tesla, is the assembly line can only move as fast as the slowest part.
Right.
And so, same thing in a console.
Yeah, in this particular case, the shift from red laser to blue laser was actually quite a sophisticated change in the way that the optical head on a drive worked. And it was a little bit of physics and a little bit of chemistry mixed together, because it's really a crystal that you're making.
Nice.
And they just couldn't make enough.
Huh. So I'm sort of curious, because, of course, you would move over to Microsoft before too long. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But how was Microsoft and the Xbox looked at from within Sony, first in the early PlayStation days, and then I kind of want to talk about it when the 360 came around as well. But starting sort of when the original Xbox launched and Microsoft, like, it's been known now, the executives, past and present, told the story of, well, yeah, we were going after Sony. We wanted to try and get into that living room. So how did you guys at the time look at the original Xbox?
So it depends on where you sat around the boardroom table in Japan. Literally.
Really?
It depended on where you sat. Because if you were on the European or the US side of the boardroom table, you'd be like, yeah, Microsoft is deadly serious and we have to be on our best game to compete. Either the other end of the boardroom table, more Japanese side, were like, Xbox in Japan? No, it's nothing.
And both were right.
Correct. And so, that's exactly right. And so as a result, there was a very spirited set of conversations that would go on. And, you know, obviously Xbox became a phenomenal competitor and contributor to the industry. So it was correct.
So when the 360 comes around and beats the PS3 to market by about a year, 11 months, I think it was, and does very well, are you guys freaking out at all, or what was the sort of mindset like in the, you know?
No, I don't. No, nobody was freaking out. I mean, PlayStation 2 was still the world's biggest selling console, even after PS3 shipped. So, you know, there was from an economic point of view, from a business point of view, game companies were making money. Sony was making money. The retailers were making money.
Everybody's in good shape.
Yeah, I think nobody was complaining. Put it that way. But I think just from a competitive market share point of view, yes, of course, it became a much more heated dynamic, and that's good. Competition's a healthy thing.
It brings out the best in everybody. Yeah. And when
hopefully
when they launch it 400 for their, you know, main, there was a $300 model too, same thing, like with you guys had a cheaper one. But when they're at 400 and you know you're coming at 599, did that sort of, did did that factor into the anxiety at all, or were you more focused on, well, these are our costs? And
yeah, I think by that point you've made your choices in terms of cell processor and hard drive and GPU and all those things, and you know, you're just locked into a plan. You know that the plan's going to get better eventually, but it's a tough one to begin with.
So Naughty Dog specifically, I wanted to ask you about them because, you know, they've always been talented. I'm sure you guys could always see that from the early days. But did you have any inkling that they were going to become what I think is fair to argue a top five, maybe even top three developer on the planet?
Yeah, my history with Naughty Dog goes all the way back to 1996, actually, because it's my signature on the contract.
Really?
That signed,
Jason Rubin and...
Yeah, well, actually, the Naughty Dog game was signed through a relationship with Universal Interactive Studios, which was part of Universal Movie Company.
Yeah.
And anyway, long story short, we did a deal with them, but it was actually the Naughty Dog game that we were interested in because one of our technical account managers had been down to visit them, just as a developer would be visited by our teams from time to time.
Sure.
And he came back and he was like, oh my God, these guys are working on this character action game. It's, I think it wasn't called Crash Bandicoot then. It was called something ridiculous.
Some code name.
Yeah, no, it actually had a name, but it was a ridiculous name. I think this is known. I forget what it was. It was
Strange Marsupial.
Yeah, it was
jumping marsupial.
It was Freddy the Fox or something stupid. I forget what it was. But anyway, he came back raving and said, we have to sign this game. And he was right. And it was something that we ended up publishing directly. And that's obviously was started... Crash Bandicoot and then Jak and Daxter series. And then what we realized as the industry was growing up that we needed to transition Naughty Dog from being more, you know, cartoon focused to being something that was a little bit more realistic.
Yeah.
And this was something that they wanted to do. It wasn't like this was imposed upon them by Shu or myself, but it was just like a realization that this was the trend that we needed to get ahead of. And then from that came Uncharted.
And then The Last of Us. Was that started? I don't think it came out before. Were you gone by then?
I'd left by then, yeah.
Yeah. So were you sort of, when you played The Last of Us, were you like, yep, that's Naughty Dog?
Yeah, because I remember being deeply involved in some of their very early tech for procedurally driven animation. You know, looking at the way that they were thinking about character animation as being a combination of an artistic vision and then reacting dynamically to what was going on in the environment. So as you were running through a world, you know, you could be flinching, and as something was shooting at you, the reactions that took some incredible engineering to make that work. And so I could see the investment that they were making there was going to yield some spectacular results.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow... grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Is Mark Cerny Sony's secret weapon? Is he like a one-man sort of genius? I've spoken to him a couple times. He seems a little shy. He doesn't seem to want to sit down and do this, but... He, to me, seems like almost their John Carmack at Sony.
I think Mark is...
What's your sense of him?
I love Mark. He's one of the smartest people I think I've ever met. And he has a vision and a passion which is clear. And he wrote Marble Madness.
Yes.
So, you know, what's wrong with that?
Exactly. The PSP, I want to ask you about the PSP for a second, because that I remember being so excited for the PSP. I had one at launch. Luminous was like, that was my favorite thing at the time. And then there was Grand Theft Auto Liberty City Stories, yeah. which I adored. What do you think happened there that made it successful, but ultimately not enough to stick around? You know, what do you think happened with PSP?
Yeah, it's a funny thing where you look at PSP and then Vita as being somehow not successful, but PSP was 50, 60 million units.
It's no slouch.
Correct. I think it's just when you're comparing it to 140 million units of a PS2.
Yeah.
There was also, I think in hindsight, you know, there was a difficult business choice made around the media format for PSP, you know, with the UMD.
Yeah.
It was difficult for people to make and sell and distribute and manufacture. So, you know, I think that held us back a little bit. But
were you involved in that at all about like the, sort of when it came down to like, well, what media format are we going to use for this thing? And
honestly, I don't think there was a better choice at that time.
Yeah.
But it was really a moment in time where actually if PSP had come out 4 or 5 years later and had been an entirely digital platform,
right.
It would have been a completely different set of realities. But Sony is a multi-headed beast. It has a music company to think about. It has a movie company to think about. And so physical media formats are an important part of its makeup. Or
yeah, because at that point, if I'm remembering my history correctly and getting the timeline right, there were the memory sticks that they used in their digital cameras, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I don't know if like that was probably as expensive or more than the UMDs, if I were to guess.
Yes. I mean, I'm not sure I remember the specifics, but the idea of using a cartridge as a format was really not leaning into Sony's strengths, which was disc manufacturing. So I think it would have been a bad choice.
So when you're made the head of Worldwide Studios, 2005, was it just sort of like another day of like, yep, I'm moving up, I'm earning, or Do you recognize that the sort of gravitas of that in the moment of like, wow, I'm overseeing all of this for the PlayStation?
Yeah, so to answer your question, yes, of course, I was very, very proud and very happy for the team to have the recognition that to consolidate all of the studios into one was a really important strategic move for Sony. And so to be given the chance to lead that was a real honor and a real privilege. We'd been working together in an informal capacity across Europe, Japan, and the US for a couple of years before that. So it was kind of a logical next step.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that it was on the cards, but it was a fun moment for sure.
So
What made you want to leave Sony and head over to Atari/Infogrames in 08? Because on paper, it seems like a bit of a curious move, right? Like, I don't know if they're, is it just a personal thing? Is it a, you know, I'm sort of curious what inspires you to do that.
Yeah, there were two reasons. One, I'd been at Sony for 16 years nearly, and I had had a phenomenal time there. I loved my time at the company, and it, as you have pointed out and been nice to discuss, you know, I went from boy to man, you know, my time there. And I realized that I was starting to repeat myself. I was starting to think, you know, we'd done PS3, we were planning PS4,
yeah,
and I was about to go into that next cycle. And to get deep into the cycle and then leave would be very bad. And also, short of moving to Japan, I had achieved everything that I could achieve realistically inside the company. Plus, I wanted to start a family. And if you are traveling once a month to Japan, that is not conducive to any kind of, you know, life outside of work. And, you know, some other personal things that were driving that. And then what I really wanted to do was to go plural, which was to do more than one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. And so a friend of mine in the industry, David Gardner, and I joined the board of Atari, or the public company that owned Atari and Infogrames. And it was a time where we then started investing in some other games companies. We created an early venture fund that was doing investing in mobile startups. Most notably was Supercell, which turned out to be a very successful mobile games company, as you know.
Were you an early investor in that, or you set it up?
Yeah,
why are you even working now? You can just cash out and go home. You're all set.
Because I love what I do.
No, it's true. We'll talk a lot more about Google here in a few minutes too. So 2 years on doing that, is it sort of just you kind of see the writing on the wall, or is it more of just like I've accomplished everything I can accomplish in this position?
Yeah, so you mean on the board of that company? Yeah, so you also have to think about when that was. It was 08 and 09 in the teeth of the financial crisis on a global basis. And I learned a lot, not necessarily the skills that I expected to be deploying. It was more about cost management than investment. And so I had a really good time as a plural investor. I also invested in or was on the advisory board of Gaikai, which actually is important moment, which I'll come back to as we talk about Stadia. And then Don Matrick and I have known each other for 20-something years, maybe. Actually, if I hadn't joined Sony in 92, I would have probably joined EA working for Don in Vancouver.
Yeah.
27 years or something I've known him. And he would persistently and enthusiastically call me from time to time to try and get me to come and work for Xbox. And then initially in the US, and then I said I didn't want to move. But by this point, we had our first son, who was very young at the time, and the idea of lifting a family to the other side of the world was not going to work. Yeah. So he called me and said, look, I've actually got an opportunity which I'd like you to consider in Europe. And so that was interesting, and we spent a bit of time talking about it.
Yeah, heading up all the studios over there, right?
So it was great.
Was it? I don't know if this is something. If like I'm just projecting this as a fan, and you don't look at it this way, but did it feel weird at all, kind of crossing over to the signing with the other team, as it were, or is that? Is that just something that like gamers think about? But you're just like, well, no, it's a career move. That's.
I didn't really think of it as a career move. It was really the things that drive me are, can I make a difference? Can I work with people I love and respect and care about? And can we move the needle forward? You know, can we move the industry forward? And so those were the things that I was thinking about. I'm well aware that there was a lot of memes around, you know, me being some kind of... spy on the inside, which was quite funny to a few of us at times. But yeah, that's just that's just great fandom, I guess, in the industry.
So you were at Microsoft from kind of the tail end of 360 to the early Xbox One era. So I want to bring up a couple of those projects from that era. Rise was a day one launch title for the Xbox One. Fan favorite, kind of a cult hit, if you will. I really enjoyed that game, flaws and all. I just got to put this to rest for Xbox fans out there.
Sure.
While you were there, was there ever any talk of a sequel to that game?
Do you know, I don't think there was.
No? Okay.
If I remember correctly, that game actually started life on the 360.
I think I remember that,
and
too.
And was moved to the Xbox One somewhat later in its development cycle. And I think if there was an interest in a sequel, I'm not sure that the developer was in a position to do it.
Yeah, Crytek went through some strange times, I guess would be fair to say. So
yeah, that's your phrase, not mine.
Yeah, but they're still here, they're alive, they're going. You know, before this just popped into my mind, I'm gonna sidetrack for a second. We had gotten wind. I'm curious, were there any real last minute names for like sort of the short list of names for the Xbox One console after you'd arrived? Because there's one on that. I want to hear it from you first before I'll tell you what I had heard was almost the name of it.
So I've only ever known it as Durango.
Right, the project name.
Project name,
yeah.
Or Xbox One.
Okay.
And I know that the team probably considered many other names, but I was not privy to the to the shortlist.
I had heard in Xbox Infinity was like a real...
Yeah, I've heard that too, but I'm not sure whether I've heard it from inside or outside of the company.
Fair enough. I got to figure, like, you're the perfect person to ask while you're here. Fable Legends, real quick. You know, that, I'm a longtime Fable fan. That game kind of broke my heart because I didn't like it, and it ultimately led to the destruction of that studio. Now, you may disagree with me on sort of the cause correlations of that, but was Fable Legends a mistake, do you think, in hindsight? Would a more traditional Fable sequel have been a better way to go?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, hindsight is 20/20 vision,
sure.
And I'm not going to make any kind of flippant remark about any time where a studio gets closed and people lose their jobs.
Yeah.
Because it's a terrible moment.
It's horrible.
In regardless of whether you're a fan of the games or the studio, just anybody who would be out of work as a result of a corporate decision, which obviously was made long after I left. I think where Fable Legends had the best of intentions was to create an ongoing service experience where you could create an experience that would then grow with players and
almost a little before its time.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. And I think that there are other examples that are doing it better now that maybe would have been, you know, more effective proxies or examples. But also the studio was not really in the right place at that time to go build a very, very rich single player RPG.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it had a huge number of other options in front of it.
Yeah, fair enough. What were the differences between Sony and Microsoft in your experience? As game companies, you sat pretty high up at both. What were sort of the... Would you think of any kind of key differences or even similarities between the two?
The food wasn't as good when I went to Redmond as it was going to Japan. That would be one difference. I love Japanese food, so that's slightly an unfair statement. I think one of the things that was very obvious to me early, actually even before joining Microsoft, is that say what you like about the company, but the people at the top of Xbox all play games and all love games.
Yeah.
And so that was clear. You know, you would come in on a Monday morning, and there would be a conversation, you know, around the meeting room table about the experience that people had had playing together on Sunday night.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fantastic. And it was top to bottom. And, you know, I think Phil Spencer in particular was driving that, but it was across the company. There was a passion for the culture of games and what that could mean for the world.
How do you think Sony has been doing this generation? What do you see from them now as an outsider? And Microsoft too, I'm curious.
I think they're both doing great. I mean, I think that Sony, from a pure business point of view, has done phenomenally well with PlayStation 4. It's great to see some of the success of their internal studios, products, and experiences that I may have, you know, had an early, you know, hand in, come to life, which is fun. I think what Xbox is doing with the shift to thinking about creating value in a subscription is interesting. And so everyone's innovating. Everyone's trying to lift the industry, yeah, which is great. Nobody's resting on their laurels. Nobody's sat there thinking, oh, I'll just wait this out and wait for the next generation to come along.
You mentioned a little while ago, I want to just circle back to it real quick before we, finally talk about Stadia, I promise. You're not here to reminisce about the past. That's for my benefit. We'll talk Stadia. But you know, you mentioned Little Big Planet. And you know, that's such an interesting game. It's maybe one of the most successful player-driven games ever made, certainly on a console as well. And was there sort of an interesting story of how that came to be? Because I would imagine, I mean, you mentioned Parappa and some interesting sort of art over commerce things that you and your team helped bring to market. But was Little Big Planet a tough sell internally? Like, I'm sort of curious about
there's a few stories to it. I mean, first of all, that whole thing came about because a guy who worked for me called Pete Hawley spent a lot of time in a pub in Guildford with Alex and Mark from Lionhead at the time.
Circularity
to this. And persuading them over many pints of beer, over many, many months, to think about leaving and starting their own company funded by Sony.
Yeah.
And they were eventually persuaded to do that. They set up, we funded them, and they came in to do their first pitch of the game, which is to this day the greatest game pitch I have ever seen.
Really?
In my life.
Little Big Planet is the greatest game pitch you've ever heard.
And it is not the game that you ended up playing.
Okay.
It was a very different kind of experience. But because just this gives you an insight into how Alex in particular works, rather than use PowerPoint, which is what everybody else on the planet at that time used to communicate an idea, he wrote his own interactive version of PowerPoint so that the game was playable through the presentation.
So good.
It was just mind-blowing. And that told me enough about the way they think and the way that they want to innovate and the way they want to challenge, you know, conventions. And what became Sackboy looked nothing like Sackboy at that point, but it was enough of an idea that we got very excited. I think we had an hour-long presentation booked, and it went on for like 4 hours.
Wow.
It was just the most exciting, creative, innovative time. We then spent, I think, 1 or 2 years incubating it, and then we revealed it to the world in 2007 at GDC.
And have you been surprised at some of the things that people have done with Little Big Planet?
Never underestimate how much spare time somebody has to go and really finesse. And
talent, too.
Oh,
there's
amazing.
So many people doing crazy stuff.
Well, also, the tool chain was not so sophisticated, but it was reasonably powerful. But the amount of innovation and iteration that was there was just phenomenal.
Yeah,
it was very exciting.
So now, well, you find yourself at Google. You've been there about 2 years.
Yep.
And by the time this airs, Stadia is launching. It is going to be heading into the market. So how has the ramp up to this been compared to a traditional console launch from your perspective?
It's fundamentally different in so many ways and very familiar and similar in others. So obviously we're building a cloud-based streaming platform that takes a AAA game from our data center to any screen in your life. So that fundamental promise is there. Last night, the reason I'm a bit bleary-eyed, I'm sat at home playing Shadow of the Tomb Raider in 4K, 60 frames per second, sat on my couch with no console.
Nice.
Now, what device are you sitting there? What's your preference? Do you do a tablet? Do you do a phone?
I was playing on my TV.
TV, okay. Yeah. So you're just blasting at the TV.
Yeah, playing on my TV.
Nice.
And it's perfect. I mean, it was just the most fantastic experience. I got to the point, I haven't played the game before. It's the first time I've actually had a chance to play it. I don't know if you've played it. But.
I mean, I've played Tomb Raider on the console, not on Stadia.
Okay,
I actually haven't had a chance to try Stadia yet myself. So I'm eager to do so.
We should address that.
I think I'm talking to the right person. Yeah, I'd be able to put that up.
So I know a guy, as the expression goes. But there are different ways to reach different devices. So Chromecast is what you use on your TV, and it streams at 4K up to 60 frames per second. Chrome browser on your PC, desktop, laptop. And then Pixel 3 and Pixel 4 phones initially. We'll expand that later.
I have to ask you a very selfish question. I'm going to waste the audience's time, but I'm just going to do this. You and I both drive Teslas.
We do.
The web browser in the car is Chromium.
It is.
I've been asked this by my Tesla podcast audience, so I'm going to put this to you right now. Google Stadia in a Tesla over the LTE connection. Is this a possibility?
I think...
You can say no.
No, it's a possibility.
It's a possibility.
It's a possibility. Okay. I think whether it would be... I'm not sure it would be a great experience over LTE.
Yeah.
But I think if you had... if you were sat in your garage on Wi-Fi, then yes, it would be an amazing experience. But it would be a possibility.
Okay, that is good to know. I'm going to file that away for later. I'm going to hold you to that. Okay, so... With Stadia, I'm the thing about Stadia that I've found in my position as a games media person is I feel like, and I'm curious what you think here, is educating customers one of your biggest challenges, sort of explaining exactly what this is because it's not a physical thing? Is education a big thing for you?
I think the most important thing is to try it for yourself. When we're done here, I'll go show you what it is. I have a controller in my bag, and I have every game on Stadia in my bag because it's on
the cloud.
Exactly. And so I think there is a completely understandable skepticism from players who have not seen it, who have not had the chance to play it.
Yeah.
But once you get to see it and once you get to play it, you realize that this is a very strong direction of travel for the future of the industry.
Where is the weirdest place that you have experimented with Stadia that you've played so far? Bus stop, train station, middle of the country, on a farm? I'm curious.
Actually, yeah, good question. I did go up last year during the Project Stream test. So Project Stream was our pre-launch trial that we ran in partnership with Ubisoft with Assassin's Creed Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
And so we launched that in actually about a year ago today. It's kind of October time. And a weekend or so afterwards, I was up in Yosemite. In a lodge which had very rudimentary Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, I'll give this a try. I'll just see if it
works. A little user testing, yeah.
Worked perfectly, flawlessly. Nice. And I was a long way from anywhere. You know, it was even just keeping the lights on was a challenge. And so I think, you know, that access to the internet is obviously rising everywhere. You know, we've 80% of US homes now have access to gigabit Ethernet. In the UK, internet speeds have increased by 25% a year for each of the last 3 years. So, you know, there's a very, very rapid increase in internet reach and performance, which will lift this.
Do you anticipate most users are going to play this at home as sort of a console-like experience on a television, or do you think it's going to be more of a mobile experience? I'm sort of...
Initially, it's going to be in the home or where you have access to a Wi-Fi or stronger internet signal that would come over from an ISP. But 5G is not that far away. And so
5G, I wanted to ask you about that.
5G will be a future unlock. But right now, we are a Wi-Fi and more traditional ISP-driven experience.
Because it's funny, when I think about Stadia, that's actually what I think about is a mobile usage.
Right.
I think it's because I associate the home with, well, I'm going to play my console
right
there. So I guess how do you convince somebody that's got a console to use this in their home?
I think there are two things that we believe strongly will be exciting for gamers. One is the quality of the experience. The power that we are putting into the data center to power the games dwarfs any console that is available today, substantially greater than the vast majority of PCs, maybe bar the absolute top water-cooled type PCs. So fundamentally, we are delivering a richness of CPU, GPU, and experience that just cannot be done realistically at a mass market today.
Yeah.
And you, as the gamer, get to choose where you have that experience. The same game, the same experience moves seamlessly from your TV to your PC to your laptop to your phone and anywhere in between. And so that modality of being able to say, well, actually, I'm going to complete this game somewhere else in the home, or my family wants to use the big screen TV and I can carry on playing without interruption, is a real transformation for the way that games are played. Plus, because the game is now using a data center to power it, the amount of tools and technology that are available to the game creator really breaks the mold.
So the Stadia controller, which again I haven't experienced yet, but
wait one there, I'll get it for you.
All right, the Stadia controller, which I magically now have here. We had a feature on this earlier this month as part of our IGN first coverage package on Google Stadia, and it's you can see sort of all see all what into the making of this. It feels good. It almost feels kind of like a little bit of a hybrid almost of a DualShock and an Xbox controller, kind of little elements of both, maybe even a little Nintendo thrown in there, like kind of a nice mix of the three. What or how many iterations did this go through?
About 100.
I believe it.
From the original first idea, and Jason, who is the designer, who deserves all the credit for a really beautiful design, he started watching people play games by observing how the fact that people don't always hold the controller the same way.
Hmm.
Once you get that insight and watch other people play games, you will realize that actually that's true, that depending on the size of your hand, the kind of game
you're playing. How do you hold the controller?
Well, fundamentally like this, but the way you put your fingers on the buttons.
That's fair. Change.
Some people use the pads of their fingers. Some people use
that's
the
true.
Middle of
yeah,
their
right.
There's a lot of different ways.
It's funny. I never really thought about it.
So that's why we have smart designers like Jason thinking about this. And he got inspired by the way that chefs in professional kitchens use knives.
Oh.
And there's a video which we launched, which I would recommend you and your viewers take a look at, which shows the thinking of this, which is the idea of a professional chef's knife has a very simple handle, which allows the chef to hold the knife in a number of different iterations. The kind of knives that you and I buy in the supermarket have a grip that forces you to hold it in one way.
Yeah.
And so he was inspired by the professional knife being able to be changed in shape. And what he actually did for the first design was to bend a chef's knife and then create the mold and create the idea of something that was rounded and then iterated and iterated and iterated. And then this was born.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. Let's pretend this doesn't exist because like a year ago, it didn't probably.
Actually, it did.
All right. Well, two years ago. If you're DualShock or Xbox controller, mm-hmm. if this didn't exist and you needed a Bluetooth controller to get on Stadia with, what are you reaching for?
Neither. And the reason it's neither is because we built Wi-Fi into the controller so that this is the computer that is actually communicating.
Right, that's going right to the cloud, right?
Correct, yeah. Correct.
That's cool.
And that is a significant innovation. It allows us to build the assistant into it, the Google assistant into it, allows us to have a very sophisticated capture capability. We have some really great plans for the future as to how we will expand that. We have a microphone built into it.
Nice.
You know, there's a number of things that we decided as first principles we would do differently, actually much of which predates me joining the team.
Fantastic. My final question for you, Phil Harrison, is this. What do you hope that people take away from Stadia? What is your ultimate goal with it?
That we have a game platform for everyone. That it's a game platform that does not require the purchase of a multi-hundred-dollar console or potentially $1,000-plus PC to enjoy the latest, greatest games, and that you can enjoy those amazing game experiences on any screen in your life just at the click of a button, that you can discover your favorite games through your favorite YouTubers or through your friends. A game ultimately is just a link, and that can then be shared seamlessly through whatever mechanism you choose. And that the games on Stadia will deliver an experience that will make people smile. And that's what I ultimately focus on, is delivering a great experience for gamers.
I feel so. We've talked about the service. We've talked about this controller. Tell me a little bit about the games that are available now and on the way soon. We've got some sort of third-party AAA titles, but then some original content coming as well.
Exactly. So as you know, we formed Stadia Games and Entertainment, which is our first-party game studio headed by Jade Raymond. She's announced her first studio in Montreal, but more to come. And we have over 40 games have now been announced for our launch window, which is between now and the early part of the new year. And some of the biggest game publishers on the planet are announced with games. Over 20 publishers now have announced titles on Stadia. We're giving every player who signs up and is buying our Founders Edition and our Premier Edition a 3 months of Stadia Pro, which is our subscription, and included in that is the full Destiny 2 Shadowkeep experience.
Nice.
Which is absolutely phenomenal at 4K 60 frames per second. They've done a great job with that. And I think for me, what I'm excited about is that we've got some of the most demanding games in every category. You know, we've got Mortal Kombat 11, a highly competitive fighting game.
Yeah, very low latency, Twitch input.
Right.
Like, you got to be precise there.
Correct. We've got shooters in the form of Borderlands and obviously Destiny. We have sports with NBA 2K20, and they have done an amazing job with that, just the production. There are times when you turn your head and you're like, am I watching basketball or am I watching a game?
I know, that game's crazy.
They've done a phenomenal job
animations.
With that. We have racing and some puzzle games and every genre covered. And then some big hitters coming in 2020 with Cyberpunk 2077, Watch Dogs from Ubisoft, and Doom Eternal from Bethesda.
And then the Tequila Works was one of your original games. Guilt, is that the
name
of it?
That's correct, yeah.
I love their stuff. That game looks really, visually looks great, and like the premise of it seems super cool too.
It is, and that's one of the things that I was excited about with Stadia, was the chance to get back to that wave of innovation that we saw 20-odd years ago with smaller games as well as the big AAA games, given space and given an opportunity to be discovered by players. And so that's what I'm so excited about.
Fantastic. And then Orcs Must Die coming up too, all kinds
thank
of
you for
stuff.
Remembering all the games.
I do my homework as best I can on this show. But Phil, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
This was a real pleasure. Phil Harrison, the Vice President and General Manager of Google Stadia. He's a big deal at Google, and he has taken the time out of his life to come on down here while he's trying to launch a platform. So thanks for making the time, Phil. For more from the best, brightest, and most interesting minds in the games industry, I've got a new episode of IGN Unfiltered for you every month. Check it out on IGN, on YouTube, or on your favorite podcast service as well.
Hey there. there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.